Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Craig Mott, who is a writer, author, and photographer based in Japan. Also, according to his website, he is a walker, and we will talk about it, what it means. And Craig has spent over 20 years in Japan and has produced a lot of valuable work capturing Japanese daily life objectively, as well as being an insider. And his insight into Japanese culture is impressive, and I have learned a lot from his curious observations. So today we'll discuss how Craig got into Japanese culture, his unique perspective of Japanese daily life, how walking helps him to discover the depths of the local culture, Craig's love for the unique Japanese cafes called kissaten, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Craig Mott. Hello, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this is exciting. I'm a reader of your newsletters, and As I said, I learned so much from your observations. So let's begin. So where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Hi. Well, yeah, thank you for reading. I appreciate that. I grew up near Hartford, Connecticut, and I grew up eating really nothing exciting. All of the food I grew up eating was super boring and super basic. Like I basically ate SpaghettiOs, like Chef Boyardee, you know, canned spaghetti and fried bologna, lots of fried bologna, some grilled cheese sandwiches, lots of those, lots of white bread, fruit roll-ups, Snickers, peppermint patties, lots of Wendy's hamburgers, cheeseburgers, French fries, Wendy's milkshakes. It was like, honestly, I'm surprised I'm alive and I don't have some sort of like terrible, terrible disease right now based on my childhood diet. It was truly unbelievably bad, but I survived. I made it.
Yeah, well, somebody said that your whole body, entire body cells get rejuvenated like 3 months or something. So maybe because you live in Japan now. Right, but, you know, I have to say.
Yeah, well, phew.
Yeah, well, but you know, you had ultimate, really delicious comfort food of America, which I happen to love as well. So, yeah, you're taking both the best of both worlds.
Yes, yeah, it was all easy comfort food mainly.
Right? Yeah, we need it sometimes. You know, we are just too strict about, you know, what culture is best, what cuisine, and we just enjoy. We go to Japan and eat the best food in America. Why not? Right? So. Yeah. Okay. So what was your first encounter with Japan and what was your impression?
When you say first encounter, do you mean like actually coming to Japan or just sort of becoming aware of Japan as a place in the world?
Yeah, it can be either way, because some people just like sort of, wow, this anime on the screen, or just happened ended up like on a stopover or something and stayed in an airport in Tokyo or something like that. So either way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I first, you know, I guess I first encountered Japan, or, you know, like the soft power of Japan cultural exports in video games when I was like 5, 6, 7 years old. With the NES, the Nintendo Entertainment System, and just being completely kind of seduced by games like Zelda. I just wrote an essay yesterday about Zelda, actually, and how like it's been this kind of weird constant in my life for the last 36 years. But Zelda certainly, like, I understood that these things came from a place called Japan. Japan, that didn't really mean anything to me. It just, all I knew is that these things I loved as like a 6-year-old, 7-year-old were coming from this place that was very, very far away. And so, you know, it just kind of created an awareness that Japan exists in the world in a way that, like, say, you know, I wasn't playing with like Israeli video games, you know, when I was a little kid or something. So I didn't know about Israel. But, you know, Japan video games, it was like, it was interesting. And then I'd say the first time I encountered like raw Japanese, like Japanese people, unfiltered, not, you know, not first or second generation immigrants, but just like people from Tokyo, was when I was 13 and I went to Waikiki. My grandparents kind of took me to Waikiki. We did this, like, it's insane to me. We didn't have that much money growing up. And I think you could just get these package deals to Hawaii that were not that expensive. And we flew economy, and it was, you know, it took forever to get there. It was kind of crazy thinking back how far we went to get to Hawaii, as opposed to, say, like getting on a plane and half the distance you could be in London or you could be in Paris. We didn't do any of that. So Waikiki, early 90s. And if you know anything about Waikiki's history, you know that the 80s and 90s were basically just, right, it was dominated by Japanese tourists and businesses kind of taking over Waikiki in this really kind of all-encompassing way. And so I remember just getting to Waikiki and our tour guide being fluent in Japanese and him just interacting with all these Japanese tourists that were sort of coming along with us on these tours and speaking to them in Japanese. I just thought, wow, that's impressive, you know, because I had been exposed to, you know, not Japanese, but like Spanish and, some other languages, but to just kind of see in Waikiki on that strip, you know, all these folks who had just essentially teleported over from Tokyo. And everyone was really lovely and nice. I in America, golf is really cheap. You can play 18 rounds of golf in a public course for like $5, or you could when I was a kid. So I played golf and I went to play golf in Hawaii, and they teamed me up with two Japanese businessmen. I was like 14 years old. And they were, you know, in their 30s or 40s, and they were asking me things like, are you married? And I was just like, who are these people? You know, it's like, they were so sweet, but also like so disconnected from all the reality that we were like kind of existing in. One guy had a hat on that, you know, these are like businessmen. One guy had a hat on that said, who farted? And so if you said it fast, it's who farted? And I was just like, what? Anyway, so, you know, little things like that kind of came together. So when I decided at 19 to study abroad, I thought going to Europe was easy. I could do that whenever. You know, if I go to England, I can look like a British person. If I go to France, I can be a French person. If I go to Spain, I'm kind of like Spanish. I can just kind of like blend in. And I thought it'd be more fun to challenge myself with a language I didn't know in a place that I couldn't blend in. And so I decided to study abroad in Tokyo when I was 19, and that was how I first got out here.
Wow. So you could pass without knowing, you are surely, slowly but surely, you're on the way to Japan, sounds like.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Okay. And then according to your website, craigmott.com, which is very cool. You are a writer, photographer, and walker. So you write a prominent publication like for the New York Times, the Atlantic, the New Yorker, and Wired. So, and you have published several intriguing books, which we'll talk about later. But what do you mean by walker?
I just do a lot of walking. You know, I've walked from Tokyo to Kyoto twice. I've walked thousands of kilometers, you know, down in the Kihanto. You know, I've done other walks up in Yamagata, you know, on the Niigata, or is it Niigata? Niigata, Nagano, sort of prefectural lines. There's a nice long trail that you can do there. But I've done, Rokujuri, Goikaido, all sorts of, you know, historical routes in different parts of Japan. Also all over the world too. I've done big walks in southern China. I've walked a couple hundred kilometers of the Camino de Santiago. So, you know, I've done big walks in England, stuff like that. So lots of walking.
Mm. So did it start, you know, your love for walking started in Japan, or how was walking so special in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I started walking. I mean, well, you know, walk. Everyone walks. You know, if you can walk, most people walk. A lot of people like walking. It's not too special a thing. But I think my first real like kind of memories of being sort of ensorcelled or seduced or kind of like moved by big walks were when I was, you know, first over here when I was 19, I would take these big long walks in the middle of the night through, you know, like Shinjuku and Shinjuku and, you know, over into Yotsuya and down into Jimbocho and, you know, Kudansha, Kagurazaka, kind of do these big kind of late night Tokyo walks. And they were just to me so beautiful. I mean, I loved, you know, moving through the city, and I loved, you know, the safety you felt, you know, where there wasn't really this sense of danger present. And I loved just bearing witness to all these lives that felt so close, you know, the way Japanese apartments and houses are constructed, you know, it's so much is sort of bleeding out into the streets, into the alleys. You can hear everything that's kind of going on in there. And I was just really moved by that experience. And I just kept doing more and more and more of these kind of night walks. And so that was sort of the first real connection for me between walking and poetry, or walking and kind of the beauty and, you know, humanity and sort of ethnography and anthropology. And then about 12 years ago, I started doing more formal historical walks along the Kumano Kodo in Wakayama Prefecture. And that really started to open up a lot of the walks, the kinds of walks that I'm doing today.
Mm, right. What I hear from walking, you know, walking by you is sort of curiosity and observative mindset, because you can just walk and blind, you know, minded, like you don't see, you may see it, but you don't watch it or hear it. And or you're so good at it, you pay attention to people normally just overlook. And also, I think Japan is a good place because, like you said, it's safe and very walkable in terms of the distance between two places, three places, and the path in the history, like Kumano Kodo, like you said, or, you know, the historic path crossing from the Niigata, Nagano in between. They're beautiful. And I'm sure, I haven't done that one, but it's just a really historic place. I'm sure there's so many guides. And I think you are really the right person to walk in Japan because of your, I think, inherent capability to observe. But also, I think you're reporting in your writing how interesting and precious it is, because if you just visit Tokyo, Kyoto, big cities, you don't see those things, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, Japan has just such a rich history of walking. You know, I mean, there is so, like you say about the Nakasendo and the Tokaido, you know, and the Sankin Kotai, and, you know, these sorts of historical, essentially walk mandates, you know, on sort of a national governmental level, that everyone would kind of head out on these roads, you know, and pilgrimages, going to Ise Shrine, visiting Hongu, all these sort of big pilgrimages too. They were all foot led. And a lot of these old roads didn't allow carts. So it was all walkers and horses and palanquins, and it wasn't, it wasn't buggies or anything like that. So it really was like a kind of a pure walking, culture. And, and along the roads, what was set up was probably incredible. What we have today is a very sort of anemic version of what once was, alongside these roads. And so it's kind of fun to think back at, how rich they used to be compared to sort of today, where it's, everything is kind of optimized around car travel. But, as you brought up about attention and paying attention, one of the things I really try to focus on these walks is to be completely offline. So I try not to look at my phone ever. I try to block everything on my phone. I'm not listening to podcasts. It's really a form of kind of controlled attention and just being present. And, people are always like, how do you, because I run into all these interesting people and, I kind of have these little adventures and folks are always like, how do you find these people? And it's just, they're there. It's like, if you're just paying attention, you will meet amazing, bizarre, wild people out in the world, And so anyway, that's sort of, the basis for a lot of these walks is to be present and to kind of bear witness to these lives that are being lived along these routes.
Right. I have to keep that, the sentence, they are there. So even on a daily life in New York or anywhere, you just pay attention offline and just so many maybe encounters with interesting people. And I really have to keep it in mind. So thank you.
Yeah.
So, and so the listeners who's not familiar with this Sankin Kotai, Craig just mentioned, so it's a, like Edo period, the Shogun era, the Shogun wants to control the power of local lords, and because they get rich, they become powerful and they may beat me. So the Shogun decided to have a mandatory saying hi trips regularly so that they have to carry all those servants and whoever, and then they cost a lot of money. And that's the way they can't accumulate a lot of wealth. And of course, along with the regular trips, there are going to be more commerce, hotels and inns and all those different businesses. So it's kind of like pluses and minuses, but it was an interesting system. And it's interesting that you really followed some of those paths created by the system of Shogun. So anyway, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss Craig's fascinating article that led the secret city of Morioka to the number 2 city to visit in 2023 by the New York Times. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
This episode is supported by HRN business members, the restaurants Popina and Gus's Chop House. Rooted in being welcoming places for people to gather over great food and wine in their Brooklyn neighborhoods. Popina, in the Columbia Street Waterfront District, is a neighborhood restaurant that slings pasta, hot chicken, and champagne. And Gus's Chop House in Carroll Gardens takes inspiration from European chop houses and casual bistros. The restaurants support HRN's creative educational reporting and storytelling that drive conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Teyama, and my guest today is Craig Mott, who is a writer, author, photographer, and walker based in Kamakura, Japan. So through walking and many other unique activities, you have written numerous very insightful, intriguing articles. And one of the recent ones was your feature on the city of Morioka up north in Japan for the New York Times. Now, the article ended up making Morioka ranked as the number two destination in the whole world to visit in 2023 by the New York Times, only after London. So even for Japanese people, to be honest, Morioka is not recognized as such a huge travel destination, but your article convinced me that I have to visit Morioka on my next visit to Japan. So tell us about Morioka. Where is it and what kind of unique charm does the city have?
Yeah, so apologies to Morioka for putting them on the map with this article. But the to explain it, when I do some of these big walks, walking from Tokyo to Kyoto, you end up passing through lots of, sometimes mid-sized cities. And, a lot of times I'm only spending a couple hours or maybe just one night in these cities. And after doing that for a number of years, I kind of had this moment where I was like, you know what? I want to do a trip that is entirely focused on kind of mid-sized cities that you usually never stop at. So like you either take the train and it just passes through, or you just change trains at the city, but you never really get off. And so I kind of looked around the country and I wanted to go from Hokkaido all the way to the bottom of Kyushu. And I picked 10 cities, and it was like Hakodate and Matsumoto and Tsuruga and Onomichi and Yamaguchi and Karatsu, Kagoshima, Yamamatsu. And one of the cities that I also picked was Morioka. And these are all kind of like mid-ish size cities, some a little bigger, some a little smaller. But I went to Morioka, this is in 2021. And in each of these cities, I did 3 nights, 4 days. And the goal was to try to walk 50 kilometers in each city to like really force myself to kind of see almost like every street in the city. If you walk 50 kilometers in a lot of these places, like you'll see everything, you'll see most of everything. And I got to Morioka, and it's up in Tohoku, so it's up in Iwate Prefecture. So it's just south of Hokkaido, right below Hokkaido, north of Sendai. And it's really up, in the north of Japan. And Morioka too, it's like right in the center of the landmass. It's not on the ocean. And so it's fairly, kind of surrounded by just mountains and plains of Iwate. And I didn't have huge expectations for the city, but when I spent 3 nights and 4 days there, I just had an incredible time. And I part of exactly what you said, which is like Japanese people don't ever think of Morioka as a travel destination. Literally in 20 years of living here, no one had ever told me to go to Morioka. No one had ever even mentioned Morioka. Japanese or foreign friends of mine, I went to Japanese university. I've been in a bunch of Japanese weddings. Like I have lots of Japanese friends, and none of them ever said, hey, you should like check out Morioka if you get the chance. Like, never, ever. So when I got there and I kind of started walking and started talking to people and started going into shops and restaurants and jazz clubs and stuff like that. And I was just shocked. People were lovely. People were open. They were friendly. They were welcoming in a way that, like a city like Kyoto doesn't have that kind of reputation, right? Kyoto's kind of seen as sort of a little bit cold. There's kind of a wall, there's a barrier you have to kind of get through. I felt none of that in Morioka. And I was also shocked by how many young people were running businesses. I kept going into these different cafes, and they were all, a couple of them were run by people in their 20s. Or I would ask, how long have you lived in Morioka? And they say, oh, I recently moved here to start this cafe or to start this bookshop. And that was just fascinating to me. Like I've been to many, many, Inaka countryside cities and villages. And it's very rare that you meet people who are actively moving to these places to do things. So there was clearly this kind of energy, this sort of magnetism happening with Morioka that to me was a signal of a healthy place. And when I say healthy place, I mean it was a place that felt like it had a future. So if you walk through a lot of the countryside of Japan, it's depopulating. There's this, you know, Shoshika Mondai, so a sort of child, sort of a lack of baby production. I'm trying to think of the English words for these terms. I've been doing all these interviews in Japanese and you know, shutter towns and stuff like that. So a lot of places, the youth are fleeing, like rapidly fleeing from these countryside cities and villages. And Morioka, it kind of had this opposite feeling, and it felt like, oh my God, wow, there's a future here. There's a kind of fresh blood starting businesses, taking over businesses. You know, I talked with business owners where it was a father and son or father and daughter running the shop, and the daughter was super excited to carry on the father's business. You know, things like that overall just really shocked me. So it was a combination of the energy, the positive energy, the youthful energy of the city. It's a beautiful city. It's a walkable city. Like it kind of rewards you for walking. You know, there's the beautiful river running through it. You have all these bridges crossing the river. You can walk down along the river. People are fishing right there in the river. There's kind of this like healthy communion happening between the people of the city and nature all around. You know, you have Iwate-san, the mountain nearby, kind of off in the distance, close by. You have some interesting Taisho architecture, late Meiji period architecture that has been pretty well preserved. And the food and the coffee are really good. So to me, it was just silly that no one had kind of brought the city up to me before. And it just felt like a great place that deserved a little more attention. So when the New York Times, well, my editor there asked me for a recommendation for the 52 Places article, I kind of immediately just thought, yeah, I mean, I want to elevate Morioka if I can. But I didn't know it was going to be number two. That was the big shot.
Yeah, next time you go there, it's just going to be a red carpet for you, and they're building a statue, a great mouth. Thank God. You can be a next city mayor or something.
I went back a month ago, and it was crazy. I met with the mayor. I met with the governor. You know, they did a press. I ran like a press conference alone with like 30, 40 journalists, like all, you know, lining up, asking questions. I mean, people were stopping their cars. People would stop their cars. They like everyone recognized me. I was on TV so much. And they were like rolling their windows down, yelling, "Arigato kuregusan!" You know, it's like, what was going on? It was insane. It was like being in the Truman Show.
Oh, wow. Maybe you get totally a free crazy housing. You can move there if you want to.
No, it's not that expensive. I'm happy to pay.
Wow. So, and the interesting thing about, you know, your future, it's also about, not just the Morioka, but do you really like Japanese style cafe called the Kissaten? So, and you have really discovered fascinating, great coffee shops, Kissaten cafes. So what is special about Japanese cafe to you? And you can maybe tell us about what the idea of Kissaten is.
Yeah, I mean, well, Kissaten are sort of mid-century Japanese coffee shops, essentially. You know, they kind of peaked. The peak number of Kissaten was in the early 80s, and it's kind of been in decline ever since then. And we're really sort of at the end of an era right now. So there's that generation that were starting Kissa in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, who are now themselves in their 70s and 80s and 90s. And a lot of these old classic shops are starting to shut down. But the sort of American analog would be something like a Manhattan diner to a certain degree. So, you know, really simple kind of comfort food. And, you know, the coffee, usually sometimes you get Kissaten that are very fanatical about their coffee and they go the extra mile and they've imported all sorts of funky beans and fancy beans, and some places do old beans so that they have old coffee beans that they serve you for kind of a extra extra bonus price. But for the most part, my history, you know, like I said at the beginning, I come from a very, very simple background. I did not grow up eating fancy food or exotic food. We ate the simplest things you could imagine, steak with just salt and pepper, you know, in some way, like almost like very Argentinian in a way, but really, really simple cuisine. And so when I got to Japan, I found it really difficult to eat anything. I mean, it was just all too complicated for me. Sushi freaked me out. You know, even like udon, certain udon dishes were just like too much for me. And so Kisaten were really, you know, kind of, kind of like a safe place for me. I could go to a kisa, I could smoke some cigarettes, I could read a book, I could have some bad coffee and eat some pizza toast. And like that for me was, that was perfect. That was a very safe space for me in Tokyo when I first got here. And so that was kind of the attraction. And then when I started doing the long walks, I'd walk from Tokyo to Kyoto, take 30 days. And along the way, I would pass through these towns. And no matter how small and how depopulated and how kind of like on the verge of disappearing a town was, I noticed that they all had two things. They had a barber shop, like a good tokoya, and a kisaten. And so on those big walks, I just started every day going into a kisa and getting usually pizza toast, because a lot of them had pizza toast, or, you know, just buttered toast or on toast, or it kind of changes a little bit depending on where in Japan you are, and having a good cup of coffee. And then the more I did that, the more I realized that these kisaten were these community hubs for these villages and these cities in the countryside, and that they were serving a real purpose, kind of anthropologically, for if you wanted to talk to folks in the town, if you wanted to understand what was happening or the history of a place, a good way to do it was to go to the kisa and just chat with the locals. And most people were really happy to chat. So that was kind of the progression of my kind of interest, or, you know, kind of my quote-unquote research or whatever into kisaten. Was it started because I couldn't eat anything else, and so they were kind of nice. And then the longer of the walks I did, the more I realized kisaten were sort of one of the few places that were kind of available no matter where you went in the country. And then realizing they were just these great hubs to get to know locals. So that was kind of the progression.
Interesting, right? Because a kisaten is—it's not like a Starbucks. It's the time like flows more slowly, and classically, there's like a, you know, crabby-faced master barista. It's like a very—you have to be very kind of well behaved in a way, but relaxed at the same time. People hush, quiet. There's a jazz music sometimes in the back, or something like the time goes slower, and someone like very observant and, you know, really appreciate offline time. I think that's a really a sacred space. And you mentioned pizza toast. Even if I heard first kisaten opened like, you know, 1888 or something, and then there's a boom. Like Paulista in Ginza, they're still there. They opened in 1911 or something. And I passed by. It looks really nice. It's in the movie in the past and all those. Some places are preserved, but I think one of the reasons kisaten still exists is the menu, like you mentioned. So pizza toast is one of them, and the thick Japanese-style bread, which we featured in the last episode. I love Japanese, but Japanese style bread, fluffy, thick, the buttered toast, and also sometimes, like you said, the pizza toast is like on top of the bread is the ketchup and, you know, garlic, all those like crazy. Some pizza-ish, but it's very uniquely Japanese pizza toast. And those things are very addictive, and there's no attitude. Like you said, you can just enjoy it, comfort food, and it's not too expensive. And Do you think it's not just a good coffee or sometimes bad coffee, but usually the combination of that, you know, you're welcome with the comforting, simple dishes, and they don't change. It's always waiting for you. That kind of kisaten, I think it's the uniqueness you don't see anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing because, like you say, the menu is sort of set. But there's no, you know, they are all run as mom and pop shops. It's not like there is some like great national or like kisaten organization that everyone has to join and like become a member of and like agree to all serve the same things. It's like this weirdly organic sort of culinary culture that grew out of, I mean, really, it's like a post-war institution, right? I mean, like the what we think of mostly as kisaten today are really kind of post-war entities, I think, for the most part. You know, and the reason why it's toast, I mean, what I heard, you know, so it's a lot of this morning culture, this like toast culture, came from Nagoya, Ichinomiya, that area. And one of the hypotheses I heard about why bread and why toast became so big was because all of the wheat that was being imported from America was coming in through the Nagoya port. So there were a lot of bread-related wheat processing sort of companies in Nagoya. And part of their mission to get like more people to eat bread was, I think they went around and they pitched it really hard to cafes. You know, so they were kind of like drug dealers of bread, you know, post-war. And then, I mean, the nice thing about toast is like, all you need is a toaster oven to cook it. You know, no one uses like a toaster, right? So it's all toaster ovens. And so you can cut it super thick. If you were using toasters, you could only do thin toast. But because you have the toaster oven, they do the really thick, I mean, it's like two, you know, it can be like 2 or 3 inches of bread. And also, if all you need in your kitchen is a toaster oven, that makes it really accessible. You know, so opening a kisa, a lot of the people I talk to, you know, they don't have a next generation because they don't want their kids to run their kisa. It's like they didn't start their kisa because they're like, oh, I really love kisaten and I want to run a cafe. It was, most of them didn't want to become salarymen or salarywomen, and at least from the people I've spoken with. And so, you know, you can run a snakku or you can run a kisaten. You know, those are kind of like the two pretty easy, you know, kind of like food related things you can do. And you set up a relationship with, you know, one of the coffee companies, Key Coffee or Caravan or whatever, and they'll deliver you, you know, they'll send a guy, they'll show you how to do the pour overs. They'll deliver you fresh coffee every couple of weeks. And you get a toaster oven, you get some bread delivered, and boom, you've got a business. And you know, I think that was really, to me, also really hilarious, is like the people that were running them, a lot of these places didn't necessarily see the place as a special place. But like you say, there is something so authentic about it. Time does move more slowly there. Something about the lighting, the way internal lighting and external lighting kind of plays and mixes together. It's not too bright inside. A lot of the wallpapering tends to be dark, or the wood tends to be darker wood. You know, the sofa isu, the sofa chairs. So everything is a little bit lower. It's almost like I always say it's kind of like in between a Western style seat and like sitting on tatami. You know, it's like the sofa isu aren't quite real chairs. You know, you're kind of, everyone's a little like kind of squatting a little bit. And so it is this weird, like kind of nether zone sitting in between cultures and time. And I think that is what really makes it kind of special. And it's also what makes it hard to replicate today. There is this sort of retro Showa, you know, Showa era boom that's kind of happening now. And I've seen a few people try to open up, quote unquote, like, you know, new kisaten in the Showa style. And it just kind of doesn't work. There's something about that full commitment in the moment that happened 40, 50 years ago that really created these special spaces. And I think that's a big part of their charm.
Right. It's like a real British pub, or try to kind of reproduce, exactly. Right? You need a history behind it. So, exactly. Yeah. And then because such a precious culture of kisaten is kind of disappearing, but you created an amazing book, Kisa by Kisa, in 2020. So do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, that was a book that came out of the walk I did from Tokyo to Kyoto. And it was sort of a pandemic instigated book, because in 2020, my plan was to do all these talks and walks all around the world. And the pandemic hit and everything ground to a halt. And I was stuck at home in Kamakura. And so I decided to take that walk that I had done, one of the walks that I had done, and sort of turn it into a book and see how that would feel and how that would come out. And so Kiso by Kiso was sort of the product of it. But it's 100% a book that kind of owes its existence to the pandemic in sort of a positive way.
Mm. Right. So again, your observation, deep observations of Japanese culture and people. So the book is more about people, right? Who's supporting the culture and daily life of those people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I'm going on these walks, I'm actively, I just don't have any interest in big tourist spots. I don't care. You know, other people can write about Fushimi Inari or, you know, Ginkakuji or whatever. And like, I'm not adding value to the world if I go to these places and write about them. And what I'm really interested in, again, because of my background as someone who came from a extremely working class town, sort of lower middle class, blue collar, I like talking to real normal people. I feel most at ease talking to those people. I don't feel at ease at all when I'm in areas of Tokyo like Hiro or, you know, Denin Chofu, you know, stuff like that. I feel way better on the east side of town, you know, in Kuramai or up in Yanaka. And so when I'm on these big walks, I love the countryside towns, and I love talking to the farmers, and I love talking to the owners of these kisa. And I, you know, my goal is to just elevate these lives that I happen to brush across as much as possible, you know, in a way that I have a few rules about how I write about the things I write about. And one of the rules is to not, you know, other these people. So it's not to like, oh, look at this bizarre farmer or look at this weird quirky kisa. It's to go, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to engage with this person directly. And hopefully on a level that feels like we're meeting each other in a way that feels symbiotically elevating. So we're both coming away from this interaction, feeling better, having learned something, feeling energized by that interaction, by life, by, you know, this chance encounter. And so I really try to focus on that element and that feeling in the writing. And so Kisa by Kisa, you know, the vignettes I'm doing of these kisaten or the owners or the people I meet along the road, I try to stay in that register, that tone of elevation and respect. And so that's kind of the driving ethos of the book.
Mm, interesting, right? Because if you go to visit any big cities, like even including Tokyo or Kyoto, you know that people you come across, they have their outside face, and you're serving you or like even stranger, it's very hard to peel off their social face, like including myself. I feel I'm kind of acting, not me.
Right.
I'm not like the person being a person with my best friend or something. So I think what you're doing is really revealing that outside face, and you communicate because you are by nature the kind of very relaxed person, and you're curious, genuinely curious about people. So yeah, that's why you ended up making such a great book. And where can we buy the book, Kisa by Kisa, if our listeners want to take a look?
Oh, you can buy, I mean, if you just Google Kisa by Kisa, K-I-S-S-A by K-I-S-S-A, the first result or second result should be the shop. So it's shop.specialprojects.jp is where the book is sold. And we just went into our fourth printing, which is crazy. I can't believe we've sold out of the first three printings, And the fourth printing as of now is about halfway sold through. So it's doing well. I'm really grateful for everyone who supported it and bought the book and all the feedback, all the wonderful notes I've gotten about it. And it's been really, a really wonderful journey.
Mm. Right. And if you go to craigmott.com, there is books and essays. So you can find that too.
Oh, yeah.
And also, if I don't mention your newsletters, I'll be missing out something big here. So you have two newsletters that everybody can subscribe to for free on your website, craigmott.com. Yep. One is Rodem, published monthly, and the other one is the weekly newsletter, Rich Wine. So tell us about these amazing newsletters.
Yeah, well, yeah, Ridgeline aspires to be weekly. It was weekly. For like 2 years, it was weekly. It was really like rigidly weekly. And then last year, it got a little looser. And I'm trying to get back onto a really rigid weekly schedule again. But theoretically, it's weekly. And Ridgeline is about walking. I just was doing so much walking and I wanted to write more about walking and I wanted to write more kind of formally and do book reviews related to walking-related books. And I thought it would be good to have a newsletter space, you know, explicitly for that subject. So it's the walking newsletter. And then, and walking mainly in Japan. And then Rodin is just my old newsletter. I've been running and writing Rodin for, I think, over 10 years now, maybe 11 years, maybe 12 years, actually. It's kind of crazy. And Rodin is just my general newsletter, and it tends to be about literature, film. I wrote recently about going back to Morioka. So I wrote the recent Rodin is called The Morioka Experience, and that was kind of a behind-the-scenes breakdown of sort of what happened with the Morioka articles and then going back into town and just, you know, really deconstructing how that felt. And before that, I wrote about archetypes, like so how archetypes have, you know, influenced me, so people I grew up with, people later in my life, just the power of having, you know, a good archetype in your life or in terms of like what you aspire to or what you can think is possible. It's an extremely powerful concept. And I was just trying to formalize that in one of the more recent newsletters and help people maybe see how they can begin to think about archetypes in their lives. So how they can either pull in better archetypes or they can recognize negative archetypes about, you know, people that are maybe sending them into bad places and can start to kind of call that out of their lives. So really the breadth of the newsletter's a little bit all over the place, which is why having Ridgeline be so focused on walking is kind of, you know, it's kind of freeing in that it's so simple to explain. But you should subscribe to both. They're free.
Right. Yeah. And your picture is amazing. You're a photographer. So something like stunning, you know, captures real like life. You know, it's not a static picture. You feel like there's an energy coming out of the photos. So I like that too. So, and also, So, well, let's see. I have to choose. I have some million questions. Let's see. So you have published a special 7-day edition of your newsletter in January called Tokyo Square. So, which I truly enjoyed reading over the course of 7 days. So what was that Tokyo Square and what did you want to communicate to the audience?
Yeah, so one of the things I like to do is I run what I call pop-up newsletters. So they're short-term newsletters, so it can be a week in the case of Tokyo, or it can be a month sometimes, or it can be over the course of a walk. So I've run a ton of pop-ups now. I've lost count, but maybe, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pop-up newsletters over the last 3 or 4 years. And what I like about these is that most newsletters, you subscribe and it's going to go on forever. There's no end date and people tend to like stop writing them at some point. And you kind of get sick of it. And it's just this weird commitment that has no edges to it. And so what I love about a pop-up newsletter is it's like, look, hey, I'm going to do this for 7 days. I'm going to send you something every day. And at the end of it, I'm going to unsubscribe you. I'm deleting the newsletter. I'm deleting you from my newsletter software. You won't get anything else from me unless you subscribe to something else. So Tokyo, Tokyo, Tokyo was the second Tokyo, Tokyo, Tokyo. I did the first one in August of last year, and it was so popular. It was like by far the most popular newsletter I've ever done. And I thought, and I had so much fun doing it, I thought I want to do another one. And so I wanted to do a winter edition. So last August was hot, disgusting, super humid, really physically exhausting. It was just so disgusting out. Don't do big walks in Tokyo in August. That's like my biggest, if you take away nothing from what I'm saying today, don't ever do a big walk in Tokyo in August. So it was really fascinating, but also really painful. And so I thought January would be great, beautiful winter light. And it was wonderful. So I did the second edition, Tokyo, Tokyo, Tokyo 2, in January. And I just set off from the same point every day. And each day I kind of have a little bit of a theme to the walk. And I try to walk about 20 kilometers. That seems to be a good distance. Some days are a little bit longer, some days are a little bit more. But I walk 20 kilometers, and along the way I stop in restaurants, kisaten, talk to folks, barbers, you know, train attendants, whatever. I talk to folks. And at the end of the day, I write, and I'm photographing all day. I'll edit the photos down and I'll write, you know, 2,000-4,000 word essays, and they go out that night. That's kind of the rule. It's like, I've got to, you know, I do the 20 kilometers, I do the 30 kilometers. I sit down, it's like 5 p.m. usually when I sit down to start writing, and I'll do 4, 5, 6 hours of writing sometimes, editing, putting together a newsletter, getting it out. And it's this sort of, a couple of readers have written in and really tagged it accurately, I think, as performance art. I mean, that really is what it feels like. It's this asceticism, ascetic practice of doing the physical labor of the walk, gathering the experiences, and then really trying to distill it as artfully as possible at the end of the day, and then publishing it, having that deadline, you know. And during that Tokyo, Tokyo, Tokyo newsletter in January, I published 25,000 words over the course of a week, which is crazy. That's a lot of words. So it's this kind of incredible creative and physical act. And I find it really freeing as a writer. And it sort of creates these hallucinatory moments and spaces where you don't have time to really overthink things, and you're just reacting in the moment to memories and who you're encountering and what you're encountering. And I just try to stay with it and be honest, and at the end of the day, kind of do an honest accounting of what happened. And so I'm glad that you enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun. I'll be doing one more some point this year, maybe in the spring or maybe in the fall. And then I want to take all of those and do a book out of those two.
I can't wait. By the way, listeners, 20 kilometers is about 12 and a half miles. So it's a good distance, but it's a long distance too. So it was very healthy, I'm sure. But I'm just curious, what's your motivation though to walk and discover and write? You know, I mean, nobody's really put the gun on your head and then write, because this is really time and energy consuming. But what's your personal motivation doing this?
No, there is a guy with a gun to my head every day. That's the only way I do it. I hire him, I pay him, he gets paid $20,000 a year to hold a gun to my head. No, it's, you know, it's like going to the gym, right? You know, it's like you go, oh, why do you go to the gym? Well, because it feels really good to go to the gym. And the more you go, kind of the better it feels. And you realize that, you know, being healthy is sort of a delight and, of life, in and of itself. And so I started doing these walks, and I started doing the writing connected to the walks slowly. I kind of built up to it. So I'd do a couple days, I'd do a 4-day walk, and I was like, ooh, 4 days, that's really big. I did an 8-day walk. Ooh, 8 days, that's really big. And maybe at the end of the 8-day walk, we'll put together like a simple photo book. You know, I started doing projects like that. And then I started doing, well, let me walk to Kyoto, and I'll do one sentence a day. I'll publish, and I'll take photos, and I'll send one photo and one sentence a day. So I started you know, really building up like you would build up in the gym, you know, lower weights, building up to bigger weights. And the more I did it and the more I sat with it and the more I produced, the more it felt life-affirming. And the richer the experiences became. And the more and more I felt at the end of the days, like I was finally understanding what a full day really meant, like what it meant to live and fully extract everything you could extract from the day, and how that felt really just so true to being alive. Like in a really kind of reductive, weird way. It's like, why has everyone fought the wars we fought to get here? Why has everyone struggled to do the struggling we've struggled to get here? And it felt like doing these walks in the way that I do it, in this kind of like fully present, fully attentive way, and the asceticism of it and kind of the physical ardor of it and then the creative work of it, I get to the end of the day and I could die and there would be no moment of regret for that day or for that week. And that's just a really good feeling. That feels great. And I've also found the more I do this and the more I share, the more I find I'm elevating people and I'm able to elevate places, and that feels really good. And the readers as well feel elevated, and they tend to be taking something special away from a lot of these projects. And I'd say the Morioka thing was a direct result of all of this. You know, it's like, I wouldn't have discovered Morioka if I hadn't been doing these walks and these projects. And I wouldn't have written about Morioka in the way I did, and I wouldn't have kind of engaged with Morioka in the way I did if I hadn't built up this training. And so then when the New York Times came and asked, hey, you know, where should we recommend? And I was able to strongly advocate for Morioka. I felt like that was sort of an apotheosis of kind of a lot of this work. You know, it's like, that's the ultimate elevation, is, you know, getting a city like Morioka, which is excited and happy to receive the attention from everyone I've talked to, has been excited about it. No, you know, and it's a city that can handle it. It's not going to be crushed by the attention. But like that kind of elevation feels really great. I mean, that I find it unlikely that I will have more of an impact in any of the other projects I do than I had with this New York Times piece for Morioka. But it comes out of the same ethos. So to me, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. So no one has a gun to my head, but I don't need a gun to my head, because the process and the doing of these projects feels so life-affirming, and I get so much out of it, and I know other people are getting so much out of it, that it's really not a big stretch to do.
Mm. Well, you totally just elevated my mind. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's also just fun. It's fun. Your body feels good. Like, if you do a 40-day walk, I mean, you look good. Like, if you, like, not, you know, not to be narcissistic or whatever, but like, you walk for 40 days, you can kind of eat anything you want, and your body is just going to like turn into this, you know, like super body. You know, it's like your legs are going to be super strong, your abs come back out, you know, your shoulders get, you know, bigger, you're carrying your pack. It just feels good. It really feels good. It feels like you're alive. And like meeting all these people, it's fun. Every day you feel, I guess, you know, what can happen in the routine, everyday routine, is you forget the potential that every day holds, right? It's like you do the same things, you go to the same places, you see the same people, and you forget. You become a nerd to this kind of sameness. And when I do a big walk like this, I remember what is possible. And I feel in my entire body this kind of breadth of possibility that a single day holds and a richness that a single day holds. And I try to bring that back to my everyday, my day to day. And I, you know, that's a big thing that I'm advocating for, is just, there's so much richness to be pulled out of every day. And if you really lean into it and you shut off the internet, pay attention, like it's pretty incredible. It's pretty magical. And you know, that's a big takeaway for me.
Well, I'm sure our listeners had a lot of big takeaway from your words. Oh my God, yeah, this, we really have to keep listening to this part over and over again to get the energy out of your, I mean, I think your honesty and also, you know, just live this moment, I think really is helping. Not just Moruga City, like people surrounding you. And yeah, you're really such an inspiring person. And I'm so glad I got a chance to talk to you. So, but, you know, you have spent 22 years in Japan now. And what part of Japan keeps attracting you? You could have been like India or China or, I don't know, like Berlin or somewhere, but you decided to stay in Japan. So what's the reason for that?
Yeah, I mean, the plan was never to stay as long as I've stayed. And it's been this kind of like tumbling forward of being here and working on projects here and then, you know, forming relationships and sort of getting more and more entangled. But really, not to be really, really kind of like basic about this, but like the stuff that to me was the most seductive about Japan was healthcare. A lack of violence, a lack of guns, functioning public transportation, a sense of kind of like a socialist society of people being supported. And so living in a place that had all of those kind of elements to it, to me was really inspiring and important. And a lot of it was in contrast to where I came from, which there were a lot of guns where I came from. There was a lot of violence where I came from. There was no healthcare. People were struggling. And so I think I didn't recognize this explicitly when I moved to Japan, but the more I've lived here, the more I've drawn kind of power and energy from the fact that people are taken care of, the fact that things do generally work in the way you'd expect them to work. And as America becomes more and more kind of dystopian in some ways and bizarre and really sad in a lot of ways, I walk Japan, and what I'm taking away from a lot of this walking is I'm bearing witness to a thing that functions. It's not perfect, but it is showing me what is possible in the world, and that feels so hopeful. And so even today, I know a lot of Japanese people think Japan is like going to the birds and like falling apart and like bad stuff. Even today, I mean, I get so much hope moving through this country, being here. I'm so grateful. I'm an immigrant. I don't consider myself an expat. I'm here, you know, I'm not going anywhere. So I'm an immigrant. I'm an immigrant in Japan. And, you know, that's really, those are the elements that to me feel so special and kind of keep me excited.
Mm. Right. Well, Japan got lucky. So good luck. And where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Yeah, I mean, just craigmod.com or on Twitter, craigmod, Instagram, craigmod. Pretty much if you just search for craigmod, you'll get it all. And you can sign up for the newsletters on my website. And there's links to buy Kisa by Kisa and stuff like that. So take a peek.
Okay. So yeah, hopefully you can come back and talk more about your discoveries, rediscoveries about Japan. So thank you so much for joining us today, Craig.
Absolutely.
All right. So listeners,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Amazing. So, well, good luck. And listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japanneeds is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer today is Amos Benjamin, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japanneeds is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.